all your hard work. Okay, so we'll move into action items. Just so that people know, we have a hearing on Confusion Hill that's going to get moved to the end of the day today. Tentatively, that's looking like after 2 o'clock, more like 3. We will then move into public workshop. Item number 8, we're going to move in front of item number 7. So item number 8 is a workshop for the evaluation of progress for implementation of the Scott and Shasta TMDL. Item number 8, you're on.
We're at 8.
Double. Yeah.
And when are we moving this?
I'm not sure.
I'm Matt St. John, Chief of the Non-Point Source Division, and I'll be introducing this item. So the topic is we're doing a 5-year evaluation of the Scott and Shasta River TMDL programs of implementation. So the purpose of this workshop is for staff to share with you some information about the status of implementation of these two high-priority TMDL watersheds, and for staff to present to you our recommendations for prioritized implementation efforts as we move forward. As you know, both of these TMDLs have conditional waivers as regulatory mechanisms to provide us a framework for implementing these TMDLs, and both of the waivers for the Scott and the Shasta have a 5-year life and need to be renewed or revised. And so today's workshop is to give you feedback on staff's assessment of the current status and recommendations moving forward with respect to revisions of those waivers. So a key part of this, of course, is to then seek both input from you, board members, as well as the public as we move forward towards revisions of these two waivers. So the format for today's workshop, I'll be giving just a very brief overview and introduction. The lead staff person for our Shasta River TMDL is Andy Baker, and Andy has one of these nasty midwinter colds and wasn't able to be here. So David Leland is wearing that hat for the day and will present to you on the Shasta, focusing on accomplishments, areas needing improvement, and our next steps, at which point we'll break for board member questions and comments from the public, and then bring it back for Brian to do a comparable presentation with respect to the Scott. And following this workshop item, we'll hear the action item associated with the Scott and the extension of the current Scott River TMDL waiver. So as you know, not sure if we have a pointer. This is a map of our region, and highlighted in the light blue outline is on the right the Shasta River watershed, and on the left is the Scott within the Klamath River Basin. The Shasta River was listed on the Federal Clean Water Act as impaired for temperature and dissolved oxygen in the late 90s, which led to the development of a TMDL addressing these impairments. And the Scott River was listed in a comparable time frame for impairments associated with stream temperature and sediment. Just for thoroughness, we can't see it.
No.
The laser doesn't work. You know where this got in the Shasta. So as background on the schedules of these two TMDL action plans, the Scott River TMDL action plan was adopted ultimately by the State Water Resources Control Board and in 2006, at which time it was the TMDL action plan was incorporated into our basin plan. The Shasta River TMDL was adopted and incorporated into our basin plan in 2007. Both of these two TMDLs were developed under the terms of a consent decree, and we highlight that to emphasize that we were working under a strict schedule. We had deadlines by which we had to complete these TMDLs. And so what that meant was that we were doing everything we could to meet the terms of those deadlines. But there were some limitations with respect to working under a compressed schedule. And so the action plans, the programs of implementation, were developed in a format that to some degree were plan to plan. So we identified actions that needed to happen at future dates. And so today's presentation will be summarizing the status of some of those actions. And what we're now looking to do is to try to knit all that back together. Well, an important parallel process that was going on as we were developing these two action plans was that the California Department of Fish and Game was developing their watershed-wide permitting program, the incidental take permits for the Scott and the Shasta River watersheds that came out of the COHO listing. And so as we were developing our action plan, we were coordinating as best we could with Department of Fish and Game and looking at the opportunity to combine efforts and to some degree kind of ride on the coattails of that effort as for TMDL implementation. As you know, 5 years later, that watershed-wide permitting program under the Fish and Game hasn't been implemented. And so that, too, given where we're at, is an opportunity for us to reassess and change course and not rely on a mechanism from a sister agency that at the time of developing our action plan we thought would be happening in parallel. Also at the time of the development of our action plans, we were, as we always do, looking at other regional boards and looking at the experience of development of TMDL action plans throughout the state, and particularly looking at how other regions were addressing the agricultural sector, which the Scott and the Shasta Rivers are largely agricultural, and so we were trying to build on the experience from these other statewide efforts. The result of this, which is summarized in the last bullet, is that our action plans for these two TMDLs are relatively compressed and brief and called for future permitting actions and planning solutions. As you know, before I go on to this next slide, in preparation for today's staff workshop, we held two workshops separately for the Scott and the Shasta Rivers. These were public workshops where we were getting input from stakeholders within both the Scott River and the Shasta River on the status of implementation of these two TMDL action plans. The workshop for the Scott was held in April of 2011, and the workshop for the Shasta was held in July of 2011. And at those times, you heard from from a broad group of stakeholders. Today's presentation is a staff presentation, and we have done best we could to incorporate the feedback that we heard from those communities into our presentation today and the recommendations that we're bringing to you. Moving to this slide, wanted to provide a linkage to the regulatory program that we're developing now. This is our regional agricultural discharge program that, as you know, is being developed as one of the actions out of the Klamath River TMDL, but as a regional ag discharge program. As we've been initiating that effort, staff has found it useful to develop and articulate what we're calling water quality principles. And these are kind of guiding principles that define what we believe is important for protection of water quality within the context of agricultural sectors. And it's important because these are the things that we think are important. And as we move through and talk about the Scott and the Shasta River, you'll see some of the themes here as we talk about the our recommended priorities moving forward with respect to the Scott and the Shasta. And I want to emphasize that we're having similar priorities across the whole region, so there's regional consistency. The way that these principles are organized is that they're broken up into kind of categories of land management, addressing riparian area management, grazing lands, as well as erosion control and tillage practices and irrigation practices, and address categories of pollutants, meaning sediment erosion and sediment control, temperature impacts to temperature, as well as nutrients. Now, these regional water quality principles go beyond the scope of the Scott and the Shasta River TMDLs and address things like pesticides, which is in the last bullet here on this second slide. And of course, the Scott and the Shasta TMDLs do not address pesticides. And so while there's overlap, they're not totally consistent. So with that, I'll turn it over to David Leland to discuss the status of the Shasta River TMDL.
Thank you, Matt. David Leland of your staff, reporting on the Shasta. The organization for this part of the presentation is actually slightly different than what I've got up here. I'm going to start with kind of a preview of next steps and then come back and go through accomplishments, areas needing improvement, and next steps. So here's our current priorities, and I wanted to start here because this reflects progress that we've made beyond the initial priorities that we had when we started 5 years ago, and reflects both accomplishments that we have made in the last 5 years, as well as experience and insight that we have gained from 5 years of working in the watershed. These priorities focus on a particular geographic area. This is one of the insights that we've gained from 5 years of work, is that areas of cold water in the Shasta represent the best opportunities for water quality improvement given the resources that we have to apply. And those areas are concentrated near and below Lake Shastina and Dwinelle Dam. So this is the Big Springs complex and Big Springs Creek, hole in the ground area, the Shasta River below Dwinelle, and reaches downstream from there. And what these are focusing on is finding cold, clean water, keeping that water in the river, keeping that water cold, and keeping that water clean. So that's what these actions here are directed at, is that overall set of objectives. And we see that again, that those are the where we have the best opportunity for water quality improvement with the resources that we have, and we'll be and are proposing to focus on that from here. So coming back to completed actions, to as to how we got to where we are at this point, riparian fencing and impoundments on the main stem of the Shasta, and in some cases on tributaries, were areas that had been identified before we even got started working on the TMDL up there, and that's been close. It's been 10 years now, actually. The local community already understood that riparian fencing was important and that the impoundments were causing problems. That work has moved forward over that 10 years. Most of the impoundments have been removed. Some of them with support from grants through our bond measures and such. Riparian fencing work is largely completed. There are still some areas that that do need work. We want to acknowledge that, and other areas that didn't need work but now do, where the practices have changed. So there's going to be that kind of thing ongoing of maintaining and tracking and making sure that work is done. But we've made a huge amount of progress on that. One of the tasks that we had identified, actually I should back up a second. You have in your packet a table of the actions, the required actions that were included in the action plan, and it summarizes the status, priority, and next steps for a whole suite of actions that were called out in the action plan. We're not proposing to go over that as part of this. I've extracted some of the main points from that as part of the presentation. One of those that was identified in the action plan was an evaluation of the interface between Caltrans activities and their existing stormwater permit and the Shasta TMDL. That evaluation has been completed. We've made recommendations to the State Board as part of the renewal process for Caltrans permit, and have therefore finished that task. The action plan also identified developing a memorandum of understanding with the U.S. Forest Service. We actually completed that task in 2009 and then have gone beyond that with the adoption by you in June of 2010 of a non-point source waiver for the Forest Service, not just in the Shasta, not just Klamath National Forest, but for all of the forests in the region. So we've taking the insight that we gained from doing these TMDLs and from understanding that a watershed-by-watershed approach to some of these larger issues was not efficient, and that we could gain both efficiencies and better coverage by expanding to region-wide. We did that with the Forest Service, and it's working. We're working both actively and collaboratively with them on implementing that waiver, and I consider that to be a success story for us. We had identified a water quality study of Lake Shastina and the discharge from the lake as part of the action plan. That work has been going on for 5 years. It had originally had a time frame of a couple of years because of extreme drought conditions during the first part of that time. It was extended in order to get a range of conditions. The weather cooperated in the last couple of years, so we have that at this point. Feel that work has been functionally completed within the context of what we were looking to do in the action plan. The work will continue, but we anticipate refocusing that somewhat because what we're finding is that the water quality issues in the lake are not as severe as what we had anticipated. There are still issues with the discharge, but in cooperation with Montague Water Conservation District, we have identified actions to address that, and some of those actions are being implemented, and we'll continue to work with them to make progress on that. So that's, again, going well. We have other actions that are ongoing. With respect to tailwater, there's actually two pieces to this. There's a piece that uh, of, of understanding tailwater that we have completed. And again, that was with a grant. We call it the Tailwater One grant. You have heard about this. Lisa Unkerfer has reported on this. It involved the mapping of tailwater neighborhoods, which was a foundation for us in understanding the irrigation system and for being able to prioritize where investments and improvements would be most valuable. That work has been completed, and the implementation is getting underway with some pilot projects and other work to modify irrigation practices and irrigation infrastructure in a way that protects and improves water quality. Timber harvest permitting program continues on both federal and non-federal lands. And we continue to coordinate with local groups and agencies, including not just the RCDs, but other state and federal agencies that are active in the watershed. And as I mentioned, we continue to work closely with and support the RCD. We have a very good relationship with the Shasta Valley RCD. They've been great partners with us on various aspects of work in the basin. One thing that we have been working together with them on recently, and that has come out of other work, is ranch planning assistance. The State Board supported a request from the Nature Conservancy in UC Davis for ranch planning assistance on the Big Springs Ranch. That ranch plan was completed and has resulted in significant changes in management of that area that have produced demonstrable water quality improvements. And again, this was something that was reported to you at the, I believe, in September as part of that workshop. Another success story, we are continuing that direction with ranch planning. We've gotten some additional funds and are working through the RCD to develop ranch plans for other ranches, and think that this is an important way to continue to make progress. We've also been working on the water use and flow issues. There have been nascent efforts to develop a water trust. It's kind of gone in fits and starts, but it is showing some signs of gelling. We've also been involved somewhat peripherally in 1707 dedications, which I've characterized here as pilot dedications, because they have been the process has been lengthy, and I would characterize it as time-consuming, frustrating, discouraging, but a couple of them have gotten done. And I guess that's what happens when you do a pilot, is that you learn where all the problems are and how to fix that. That process needs to be improved to make it smoother, so that landowners are encouraged, not just landowners, but those with water rights are encouraged to, that they can get through the process and have a success without feeling like they have been sucked completely dry in the process, so to speak. We continue to work on system improvements, as I've mentioned. I mean, the tailwater piece is a part of that. There are other opportunities for managing diversions better. This has partly happened with respect to the impoundments, because the impoundments that have been removed were also diversion structures. So there's a lot of work that continues to go on in that area. We're also addressing a variety of potential sources through existing or permitting mechanisms that are under development. We are in the process of developing a waiver that would rely on the five-county coho salmonid program as the basis for a general certification for maintenance of county roads. That would address our five northern counties. We're hoping to be able to expand that to include the rest of the region as well through another program that exists in the southern part of the region. We had called out in the action plan county grading ordinance as an important element of managing sediment and therefore associated nutrient input, not only in the Shasta but also in the Scott. The county is working on a land development permitting process, so that's being addressed. We have statewide stormwater programs. I've mentioned the Caltrans stormwater permit. We also have industrial and construction stormwater permits that are relevant here. These are statewide permits, as is the Phase 2 municipal stormwater permit, where we have that permit is in the process of being revised and will be reissued sometime soon, and we're recommending that the City of Yreka be included as a Phase 2 permittee when that permit gets renewed. We also continue to implement the 401 program, which addresses permitting of dredge and fill and in-stream activities. We have areas where we see the need for improvement. The existing conditional waiver doesn't clearly include provisions for irrigator participation. We want to make that clear in a revised conditional waiver or renewed conditional waiver. We also want to continue the provisions for enrollment and reporting, but make those more structured and implement them more consistently so that all of those people who need to be enrolled and reporting are enrolled and reporting to us. In conjunction with that, we want to do a better job of being able to support landowners who are enrolled and recognize those who are enrolled and continue to support the RCD and other cooperators for their participation and support of us in this process. And then finally, we want to and need to develop a monitoring program to be able to track progress on a number of different levels. I've called out three here. At the beginning, to be able to better document that practices that support water quality are being implemented, to be able to track the effectiveness of those practices, and then to also be able to track, and this is down the road further as we begin to see improvements, to be able to track trends in water quality with respect to, in the Shasta, we'd be looking at temperature and dissolved oxygen and nutrients and organic matter and those constituents that that affect dissolved oxygen. So next steps are revise the Shasta waiver. We are scheduling and targeting for a board workshop in June and then a hearing on a revised waiver in August. And then to continue to focus on our current priorities, and again, these tailwater management, preserving cold water, improving riparian areas, and targeting that in areas of salmonid refugia in the Big Springs and hole in the ground in nearby areas, all directed at keeping cold water in the river, keeping it cold, and keeping it clean. We anticipate that that will be our focus, not to say that we would exclude other targets of opportunity that might come up. There are lots of other things going on in the watershed, and as those, as someone comes forward and says, can we get your help on this, we're not going to be saying no. We're going to be engaging where we can with them. So with that, I'd be happy to do my best to answer questions that you might have.
And I would remind folks, if you're looking to address the board, please fill out a speaker card, because I have none on either of these items right now. Board member questions?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
David, could you, the Duanel Dam is an 800-pound gorilla nobody wants to talk about. It's going to be there, and it's obviously changing. We got less than we expected in terms of detriment to the water body. Can you give us a kind of a broad stroke on how much it does and how much it doesn't in terms of what we know right now?
How much it does and doesn't do in terms of
detriment
impacts
to the beneficial
on water
uses.
Quality?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a challenging question. Any impoundment like that has the potential to affect downstream water quality because it changes the quality of the water. It's certainly, because it's an impoundment and it's designed as a diversion, it's affecting the flow regime in that reach of the river and downstream of that. So those are kind of in the broadest terms. The concerns, the specific concerns that we had in this case were that the water discharging from Duinelle, they do have an obligation to discharge some water for what are called prior rights. There were water rights that existed prior to the construction of that dam. Montague is obliged to release some water to meet those prior rights. And we had a concern that water was, in particular, of low dissolved oxygen, as it might have been withdrawn from the lower parts of the reservoir. Evidence suggests that might not be as severe an issue as we thought because of the way that the water is delivered. We're currently working with Montague to get a better characterization, a more real-time characterization of that, which we would like to have more information on. And of course, any dam like that represents a passage barrier, which is not our particular regulatory responsibility, but there's an entire set of river miles and tributary miles upstream of Duinelle that are not accessible any longer. So that's another issue, but not one that we are tackling.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hess.
Thanks, David. You know, at our last meeting, we had our presentation from the RCD with Dave Webb and Adrian, and they gave us a really good portrayal of what's happened, as well as their recommendations for where they think we need to go, what's working, what's not working, and I see a lot of that's kind of echoed through some of the slides that you have. You know, I underlined a few things, you know, irrigator participation for areas needing improvement, landowner and cooperator support, develop a monitoring program. The RCD is a liaison to the community over there is just huge. I don't think we undervalue that, but I think we need to strongly continue our support of them any way we possibly can. I think it's going to be really essential for us to be able to move forward and work over there. And I know that, you know, it's been challenging at times just in the way that we, not in our relationship with them, but just the ability to just execute working with them. And however, me personally as a board member, or however we can continue to foster that and encourage that, I think there's lots of opportunity to be able to continue working forward with them. And if we're not looking at that, we really need to be. So I think it's pretty critical.
We agree completely.
Great. Other board member questions? Dave, John Corbett.
Well, I would just hope that as we get into problem solving, we get some type of deadline system or greater tightening up. In one sense, some of the collective units, people have exercised, you know, their freedom not to join and their property right not to join those groups. And that's well and good, but at some point we have to have solutions. And whatever we can do to encourage the local community, because otherwise the alternative is the state will come up with solutions, and sometimes we're good at it and sometimes we're not very good at it. And so I really would hope that we have a structure that we can deal with what comes back from the local community, because they have some choices, and we're, you know, certainly been looking at it and trying to support those choices, but at the same time we got a job to do at the other end of the day.
Thank you, John. You know, I think one of the areas where we see the need for improvement that I mentioned is in this whole enrollment and reporting piece, and I think that partly gets at what you're speaking to. I mean, within that, we also see the need to continue to kind of prioritize and work on the places where we think we have the most effect. And at this point, that area that I mentioned below Duinelle is where that seems to be the case. And what I would see is as we get some of those areas better aligned, that we can propagate those experiences and those successes downstream, so that as we're able to keep to improve water quality in these upstream areas, to then keep moving downstream and keep that improvement propagating downstream.
And then I do think it's important, and I realize we're getting close to a mixed message, and so it's delicate how it's done. But We do need to praise people for what they've been doing on the riparian rights, and that's a lot of effort and a lot of money, and a lot of progress has been made. And so I think we need to recognize that as well in this when we're going forward, so people know we're noticing.
Yes.
Otherwise, sometimes you can look at, well, no matter what I do, they keep coming back for more as a regulatory body. And I think we need to carefully evaluate it. But it looks like we're making real serious progress there.
Yeah, and those were, we got some specific suggestions from the RCD with respect to that on doing a better job of recognizing landowners who are participating, and we hear that and think that that's important. Another initiative that we have going that I think also will address your point, John, is the watershed stewardship effort that Clayton Crager and the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program are engaged in. They have approached the RCD and the Shasta community as a pilot for developing a watershed report, basically, something that we would like to see all the watersheds doing, which would document where things are, where progress has been made, and then would become a vehicle for a variety of positive outcomes, which one would be to communicate what's going on and to be able to celebrate progress and success. And so, you know, Clayton is working working with them on that as the first of the watershed reports for the basin.
And then my other comment from a resource standpoint, this is apt to be a pretty tough year for people in the basin because we got less water and more fish, and that's a very challenging combination.
Indeed.
David, can I ask you a question? John started or asked the question about some of this, but as far as it goes, then enrollment to me has two sides to it. There's the people that are doing the right thing. They enrolled, they're going forward. In fact, they even participate and give us a report. But my recollection is that's a rather low reporting right now. At the same time, prioritization, which I think is key in this thing, is just that, you know, this is a journey of 1,000 miles. And so prioritization not only of your staff and staff efforts here, but also prioritization within the watershed. And kind of just overarching and looking at that, the implementation, the monitoring, and the reporting that all go together. I think in some ways we need to do this very much with our eyes wide open. I think prioritization absolutely has to happen. And I think some of the work, especially towards tailwater neighborhoods, especially with also respect to riparian, is very much going down that road, and I think that's very good. At the same time, with a conditional waiver, there's coverage of a waiver of a broad universe of property owners out there and land people that are covered with a waiver that, in my mind, the conditions aren't very explicit. Is it a condition of the waiver to report, and if you don't report, then what? And I think development of some tools, including your enforcement tools, would be a good thing. I think that going with the thought of recognizing the good, there are certainly issues in these watersheds that I think deserve attention from the other side of the ledger. I realize that that's tough. At the same time, let me ask you, monitoring plan, capital M monitoring plan here. You have three elements of a monitoring plan: implementation, so the monitoring program, that would implementation of practices, effectiveness of practices, and water quality trends, and those are very divergent things. To me, can you maybe expand or break down what you see as the key elements of a monitoring plan and as they pertain to the Shasta here?
Well, I mean, with respect to implementation, you know, we have broad knowledge of important practices like riparian fencing and tailwater management to minimize returns, and we also have specific information about where fencing has been put in and to some extent where tailwater returns are happening, and are picking, you know, have worked on the, as has the community, it hasn't been us so much, but we've been involved in some of this, but have been working on the riparian fencing, and I think are close to being able to map where all of that work has been done. We certainly can on some of the properties. Same thing with tailwater. The tailwater neighborhood piece has helped us understand where tailwater is returning, and we're, again, with Lisa Unkerfer's able support on this, are picking off some of the highest priority of those where we have a willing landowner, and are improving the management so that those returns are minimized or eliminated. So that's something quantitative that we can point to, that here's an implementation practice that has been put in place. In conjunction with that, Lisa has been doing monitoring to show that in fact, when you put in the fencing and you reduce the tailwater return, you get an improvement in water quality. So that's both a measure of the effectiveness of it, that the cows are being kept out or that the tailwater isn't returning, and it's a trend monitoring piece that we're getting a water quality improvement in the receiving water. So as an example, those are the kind of elements that we would be looking at in the implementation and effectiveness. What are the right practices? Are those practices being put in, and do they appear to be working? And then the trend piece is where we need to do some more work. We do have trend monitoring and TMDL compliance points that were identified in the Shasta TMDL. There are three of them. And what we haven't done is put that in the context of a receiving water monitoring plan that not only includes those three but may include other critical points, and that then establishes a consistent and every year set of instrumentation to track what's going on with those places. So that's the challenge that we have at this point. And again, I mentioned Clayton's name. He has volunteered to help on this, help put together that monitoring plan, and we'll be working on that over the course of the next 6 to 8 months to begin to craft up something that would address that trend and compliance piece that needs to be looked at.
Well, and I think a monitoring plan is a very important thing, a well thought monitoring plan. And Matt, you mentioned it was a plan to plan. The first implementation plan here, action plan, was a plan to plan. And I don't expect that possibly you would have a monitoring plan all thought out and inked by June or maybe even August. But as a priority, I would think that that would be a very good thing to have in the very short term for the renewal waiver, because I agree with my colleagues that in the players that are here, the RCDs and some of the key landowners and players here, that they need to be part of that plan and part of the development of that plan. And I think that that's a key element in measuring not only success, but measuring, I don't want to say failures, but areas that need attention as well. And I think, too, that when you look at monitoring, my thoughts on monitoring is that there's in-stream monitoring where you measure DO and temperature, and then there's effectiveness monitoring where it's measuring percent of riparian fencing or, success of reestablishment of riparian vegetation or those types of things. And those are very different metrics, but equally important in my mind. So.
Right, and we agree completely with that.
And yeah, I see you have it as a high priority. I just don't know timeline. And again, I don't expect you to go into a workshop in June, likely, have a completely done monitoring plan, but it seems to me that it would rank as a high priority, which you have it here now.
Well, I'm glad to hear you don't expect it by June.
Let me ask you, as another question, you mentioned the development of the irrigated ag waiver, because the irrigated ag is a primary component of these two watersheds that we're discussing this morning, and how do you foresee that the irrigated ag program, which actually comes after this process that we're going through right now, we're embarking down a road to renew the Shasta as of August. And in parallel to that, there's a stakeholder process which is just getting off the ground and seems to be doing well for the irrigated ag. But there's, it would be prejudicial for me to, start to judge outcomes or expect outcomes on the irrigated ag program that's just getting developed. But yet I see that as being a key component of implementation, on-the-ground implementation for these TMDLs. So I assume, that we would see a room left in the implementation plan or the revisions that you expect here to have room for that implementation to happen. How you craft that, I don't necessarily know. Because it seems to me, we were talking about it recently just from the standpoint that, we never seem to have these things all synced up and aligned together, and they never are going to be that way. These programs run in parallel.
And yet the irrigated ag program is and can be a very effective tool and component of the implementation for TMDL in these watersheds.
Well, yes, it can. And I think long-term, from the perspective of consistency and fairness and regulatory efficiency, that we should have one ag waiver or ag permitting program for the region, and that the Scott and Shasta should be included in that. But how we get there is open for discussion at this point. And we've begun that discussion with the Scott and the Shasta community. We need to have that discussion in a lot more detail, and we intend to do that as part of the ag permitting program process, to have that conversation, because there are a number of different ways that this could flow from here. One possibility is that we reissue the Shasta and the Scott waivers, and that those run for their full 5 years, and at the end of that, they get integrated into the regional permitting program, which would be up and running by that point. We certainly hope, at least. And with that in mind, the way that we're thinking about this is that the requirements that we put into these versions of the Shasta and the Scott waivers should reflect our best thinking with respect to the ag permitting program region-wide, so that there isn't a lot of light between what people are going to be expected to do in the Shasta and Scott within those watershed waivers and what people are going to be expected to do in the ag permitting program for the region. And that, we hope, will make a transition at a future time as smooth as possible. So that's conceptually what we're thinking about. There's a lot of detail there.
I think that's very good, by the way. I think not only the running things in parallel, course correct to meet in that middle and have that sync and jive to supplement each other, but not be necessarily two very different requirements. And at the end of the day, that a TMDL, which is an outlier requirements at the egg program, then puts things out there that are maybe much different. So I think that's very smart. I think that also helped you with your prioritization of efforts here too, because typically those things, I think, are going to remain in parallel, remain, you know, supplemental to each other. So that's great. So you come back in front of us as staff, you come back in, it looks like another workshop in June, and potentially enrollment in August is what you're talking about here.
Or a waiver for your consideration in August, yes. Yes, and just to get back to another point, we may want to come back to this later. You identified another area where that's very important, and that's the tension between our obligation as an agency to provide coverage for those people engaged in activities in the ag sector that could affect water quality, and the resources that we have to actually be able to accomplish that. And we've been doing some thinking on that, and we've got kind of a schematic of a permitting, an approach to permitting that would incorporate risk management as a way to bridge between those two, the obligation and the capacity. And maybe we can come back to that after we go through the Scott, because this would apply in the Scott, it could apply in the Shasta, and it could also apply in the regional ag permitting program as well. So it might be helpful to spend a few minutes on that a little bit later.
Fair enough.
Okay. All right.
Any other board questions? Okay. This is an information item. As far as that goes, then my understanding is we'll move to the, and I don't have any public speak requests for this, so. Stand correct.
Would be is
I think that this is a speaker card pertaining to Shasta and Scott, so what I would like to do is push us to the end and move on with the staff presentation and you gentlemen in place. So I would ask you then, barring any unanswered questions here or issues, why don't we just press forward and transition to the Scott, jump on Watershed West, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
So Mr. Capetta.
Good morning, Chairman Noren and members of the board. Brian McFadden, your staff. So recall that the Scott River is listed on the 303D impaired list of water bodies for temperature and sediment impairment. And our focus and the action plan's focus is on riparian vegetation for the support of shade that keeps water cool and control of sediment sources, and also promoting a better understanding of groundwater to understand opportunities and the interaction of groundwater and surface water. And so keep that in mind as I walk through this presentation. My presentation is following the format that David's presentation on the Shasta just did. So I'm going to start with the action items, the items in the action plan that have been completed. Like in the Shasta, the Scott action plan called for an evaluation of the Caltrans stormwater permit. We've done that. We've submitted comments to the State Board. Also, the Forest Service Memorandum of Understanding was a big component of the Scott TMDL action plan. The Forest Service owns about half of the watershed. A lot of that's wilderness and managed in, you know, for those values, but they also have an extensive road network, and the Memorandum of Understanding focused a lot on their management of the roads and completion of an inventory and a schedule for schedule and priority for addressing those road sources, and also some identification and management practices and that sort of thing. And I really need to give Klamath National Forest some credit here. They've stepped up and really taken this to heart, and they've completed their inventory of sediment sources and are moving to implement the actions needed to control those sediment sources, and that's going well. The action plan also calls for a compliance and trend monitoring plan that identifies the types of monitoring and locations and frequency, that sort of thing, and methodologies for the monitoring that would be required for decision makers in the future to take a look at that information and understand how water quality has changed and what the condition is relative to water quality objectives. That plan has been completed. The action plan calls for the county to develop a groundwater study plan. The county has completed that plan and has been working with stakeholders, including the RCD and Watershed Council, to implement the plan. I'm going to talk more about that later in this presentation, but we get to check the box there for the groundwater study plan. It's a fine study plan, and that's been a successful completed action. The action plan also calls for an evaluation of suction dredging practices and some recommendations on whether or not are on permitting actions that might be required to address that. And that action was completed, although I'll have to say it was completed in the context of the Klamath TMDL. But we've done that evaluation. There are a number of thermal refugia areas in the Scott that are identified in that in that part of the Klamath TMDL action plan. And we've also submitted comments to DFG on their permitting program that they've been considering for suction dredging. And so that's another item that we've completed. There are some activities that we're always doing and will always be doing, but they are an important element of our approach to implementing the Scott Action Plan. Of course, we coordinate with the local groups and agencies, you know, the RCD, the Watershed Council, Fish and Game, the county, those all come to mind. we get a lot of TMDL implementation done through our ordinary permitting programs, and 401 Water Quality Certification Program is an example of that, as is our Timber Regulatory Program and implementation of the U.S. Forest Service waiver and Stormwater Program. And then also enforcement is an ongoing task that we have that that is a tool for implementation of the action plan, and that's continuing also. So I want to talk a little bit more about the groundwater study in detail. We've been fortunate to have the involvement of Dr. Thomas Harder from the UC Davis Cooperative Extension Program as the lead scientist on this study. He's very well respected in his field, and I have to say, I've listened to him on the radio the last two mornings on KQED. It's pretty interesting. He's very involved with groundwater issues throughout the state, and has been a force in this whole study program. He's the lead author of the study plan. But there are some other things to highlight as well. The RCD and Watershed Council took the lead in developing a static level water monitoring program where they're monitoring the static water level in wells, and I believe there's over 35 wells that are enrolled in that program that they're monitoring, and that has continued since shortly after the adoption of the action plan. That's an effort that helps, that feeds information into the groundwater study. The Siskiyou Resource Conservation District also applied and was awarded a grant to do some other data collection tasks that were identified in the study plan to feed, and that grant will feed data into that study, and that's underway. Dr. Harder and his team, and primarily in the case of the initial groundwater model, graduate student of his, they developed an initial groundwater model. That's been completed, and now they're in the second phase of development, and really increasing the resolution of the model by at least an order of magnitude is the way I would describe it. Where before the study was looking at water use on sort of a valley-wide basis, and now the approach that Dr. Harder has developed with his team looks at water use on a field-by-field basis, really. And so that's underway. And then finally, another piece of this groundwater study picture is the county has established a Scott Valley Groundwater Advisory Committee. That group has, it's made up mostly of water users, and this group has been interacting with Dr. Harder and has been a good entity to bounce information off of to ensure that it's correct and get information from them regarding practices. And you know, I was at a Watershed Information Forum meeting last week, and there was an update about this, and I heard the chair talking about the concept of developing a groundwater management plan, which a few years ago that wasn't on the table. And so I feel like this group is really making some progress. So I wanted to highlight the groundwater study effort because I think it's going really well, and it's not an element of the action plan that has a lot of deliverables, but there certainly has been a lot of delivery on it. There are a number of regulatory mechanisms that were identified in the action plan that that in the course of our moving through and implementing the action plan, it became clear to us that there are other approaches that are going to serve the same purpose but are better choices. The action plan called for a memorandum of understanding with the county, and David addressed this a little bit. The memorandum of understanding kind of represented that approach that we employed prior to the non-point source policy, It's clear to us it's the conditional waiver is a better way to address that that need and accomplish the same goal. And so we're moving forward with development of a conditional waiver for county roads that would certify a five-county road program. The action plan also requested that the county develop a grading ordinance, and the county didn't wish to develop a grading ordinance and instead has developed a land development program and land development manual that talks about the conditions that are required for control of sediment and other water quality concerns during development. That and the construction stormwater program picks up a lot of that identified need that the grading ordinance was expected to address. The action plan also calls for the development of criteria for when we would require grazing and riparian management plans and also erosion control plans. And we've sort of developed informal criteria that we've been using, but we don't have formal criteria. And we see that the Scott TMDL conditional waiver and the next edition of that is a good forum or a good mechanism for satisfying that need. And so we're proposing that be addressed through that mechanism. Also want to just highlight some of our grant program activities that have been implementing the TMDL. They're not called out really explicitly in the action plan, but this is truly an important part of our TMDL implementation. And we've gotten grants, grant applications, and awarded grants for a number of those categories that I spoke of. You know, riparian management. We've got a couple of grants, or in one case, well, not in this category, but in some cases, we've used our contract resources to implement similar to a grant. But we've got grants for upland roads that address upland roads, as well as riparian issues, and then, of course, the groundwater piece that I spoke of. And then we've also developed and awarded a small contract to the RCD for education and outreach that resulted in a few public meetings and a educational flyer about the permitting process for working in stream and the agencies you need to talk to and individuals, phone numbers, etc. There remain areas that need improvement in our approach to implementing the TMDL. The permitting of dredge and fill and those other in-stream activities needs improvement in a couple of ways. The first being working with our sister agencies on a coordination of permitting. That would involve, you know, our approach, the content of those permits, and also the possibility of some permit streamlining that we're going to look into. And despite our efforts to get the word out about the need for permits while we're doing work in stream, it's clear to us that there's still work to do on that, and that there remain people in the valley who haven't heard that message that they need to be coming to us for permits when they get in stream. So there's a lot of work to do still there. Another area of improvement has to do with upland roads. We sort of have this regulatory gap where roads that are associated with timber harvest plans and also timber sales, but let's put the Forest Service aside and just talk about the private roads. The roads associated with timber harvest plans get addressed through that process, and through our general WDR for timber, there's a requirement that they inventory the sediment sources and address them, but there's still a lot of roads that are supporting those activities that don't come under the control of the plan, and so we need more effort on addressing these sources, and then also a way of addressing them in our regulatory program. And there is an effort that's underway that involves mostly the private timber companies, but the Forest Service has also been involved. And that effort is an effort to take into account all the work that's been done in the past, and there has been quite a bit of work done in the past to control sediment sources in the uplands of Scott River. Taking into account where it's been done, where it hasn't, where it's been sort of done halfway, where the inventory has been completed but it hasn't been implemented, and come up with a sort of master list of actions that need to occur, and then overlay that with the resource need to come up with a priority so that we don't have the situation that we were seeing, where all these different entities were submitting grant proposals for controlling sediment sources from roads, and it was clear they weren't working together, coordinating, and they weren't successful in getting those grants, partly because of that. And so the approach going forward is to have this sediment reduction strategy that's a coordinated approach, and also prioritizes the work so that the work is done in the place where the biggest bang for the buck can be realized. And so that's an effort that is moving forward, and we want to include that in the next edition of the Scott TMDL waiver. So that's a good segue to talk about the waiver. The current waiver doesn't require enrollment, and instead there are it's a two-page document. It basically says the individuals who are implementing or managing their properties consistent with the TMDL are covered by that waiver. But there's no transparency there for us. We need a better way of identifying where the good things are happening and where they're not. We had the April workshop that Matt mentioned and heard from a lot of landowners. It's clear to us that there are a large number of landowners who are implementing practices that implement the TMDL and are doing good works and engaged in good stewardship practices. There's also other landowners that we never hear from. It's not clear to us that they're implementing the TMDL, and so so there's some work to do on fixing that in the next edition of the Scott TMDL waiver. Another area that we feel needs improvement is enforcement. And we've recently made some changes and did some reshuffling, and we're going to have some more resources directed at enforcement moving forward, but there's work to do. So the next steps moving forward, of course, the biggest thing is revising the Scott TMDL conditional waiver. And what we're proposing as the focus for our next 5 years is focusing on repair and management, those private upland roads that I spoke of, and also the coordination with the Forest Service you know, the Forest Service has their inventory completed, but you know, the nature of the land ownership in this area, there's, you know, it's checkerboard pattern. There's private land mixed in with Forest Service land, and so a part of that moving forward is ensuring that everyone's coordinating on these things, and that's happening. Another focus in the waiver is that we are proposing is implementation of practices, but also I would say identification of appropriate practices. One of the things that we've heard a number of times is that we haven't clearly defined well enough what we're asking landowners to do and how they can comply or what they need to do to comply. And the approach that that we're working on with the next waiver would build on the water quality principles that Matt presented earlier, and would also identify specific management practices that we feel achieve those principles and are an avenue for protecting water quality. So having that identified on the one hand, and then also providing some flexibility for landowners to propose other practices that would achieve the same principles. And so there's a little bit of a dance that we're trying to do in terms of identifying practices, but also providing flexibility. And then, of course, we need to have an enrollment and reporting mechanism as part of the next waiver. Again, we need to know where the good things are happening and where they're not, and enrollment and reporting mechanism is pretty key to that. I mentioned the need to coordinate with our sister agencies on permitting issues, so that's the next step. Also, we need to continue to support the efforts to better understand the groundwater dynamics. So that's also something that we're going to be continuing to keep as a focus. Community outreach and education is always essential, as Mr. Noren's comments were just alluding to. And then we also need to continue and step up our compliance assistance and enforcement activities. And I mentioned that you know, we've made some changes to try and affect that. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about Scott TMDL Action Plan implementation.
I just had a very quick comment. I like your interagency coordination. I do have the perspective regarding the U.S. Forest Service that we granted them a permit for an enormous amount of property, and I do not think that permit can anticipate all that's needed within the Scott and the Shasta. And so it's great we've completed a waiver process. It was a real advancement, but I do think for the Scott and Shasta, we need to view them not only under the permit, but also what's needed in that watershed. And we also have to avoid almost, I think it's very important that we keep parity between what you require the private parties and the government, because it tends to build resentment if they get a little better deal or not. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But I do think the Forest Service needs to be coordinated with their waiver plus what's needed in the Scott and Shasta.
I agree, and thank you for that. You know, we mentioned there's the Forest Service Memorandum of Understanding, and then there's also the
right.
Forest Service waiver. The Memorandum of Understanding hasn't gone away. And that memorandum of understanding really does call out some very specific things that are needed in the Scots. And also, there's a similar element of that memorandum of understanding that addresses needs in the Salmon River also. And so that's kind of where our watershed focus is spelled out in regards to Forest Service activities. But I hear your point that the Forest Service waiver doesn't...
And I will meet with you on it if you want later on.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Noren, I had offered to go over this conceptual permitting framework concept, and I, at your pleasure, I could do that now, or I could do it after we get finished with questions on the SCOT, or whatever would work for you guys.
Appreciate that. Any board member questions prior to?
I just have a comment.
Please.
I just want to say that I've had the opportunity on several occasions to go up to the SCOT and the Shasta and witness Andy and Brian's interaction with the community up there. And it's always nice to see the smiles and the handshakes. They definitely are probably not always met with open arms, but somehow both of them have managed to create relationships there, and I just want to commend you on that.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Brian, the SCOT, these two watersheds are sister watersheds in my mind, right? They're at least contiguous. I know that they have great differences, but they have at least a consistent land use for the most part. However, the difference being in these two plans, they came about at the same time, but they are different in that the SCOT has a monitoring plan in place already, but it doesn't have enrollment. Conversely, the Shasta has enrollment, but no plan.
Correct.
So going through then, and I'll ask kind of the same question that I asked before, the monitoring component to this, I think it, to me, is an important component, whether it be specific water quality monitoring, whether measuring DO and temperature responses, those types of hard parameters, versus a success, kind of what, more like what we talked about earlier on the Shasta, where there's more of an evaluation type monitoring, effectiveness of implementation, effectiveness of action. Can you break out for me the plan as it is today in the SCOT, and how does it have those tracking elements to them now? Can you talk about that for one moment?
The compliance and trend monitoring plan primarily focuses on in-stream sort of parameters. You know, it's more about the water quality trends. Although there are some elements of the plan that are useful in tracking progress in, for instance, repairing vegetation and that sort of thing, but it doesn't address implementation monitoring. It really doesn't. I think, you know, the way we're looking at this, the approach going forward is implementation monitoring is part of that reporting that goes on in conjunction with the waiver. And we've developed an approach for the SCOT TMDL waiver that that was largely based on the Region 2's ag waivers and grazing waivers in Tomales Bay and Napa and Sonoma rivers, Napa River and Sonoma Creek. What the SCOT TMDL waiver and what those waivers require, but what the SCOT TMDL waiver is likely to require is some sort of self-inspection with some a checklist and some annual reporting about inspecting property, ensuring that the practices are working, also some photo point monitoring, perhaps, you know, that sort of monitoring where we can verify that the action taken is having the desired effect, but it would be on an individual basis. That's the way we're looking at it. Do you have any suggestions?
No, I could, to me, it kind of dovetails too also with the prioritization, kind of what we were starting to talk about at least. I mean, this needs to also go through the enrollment process, and that's a difference in these two watersheds as well. So you're going to, as I understand then, in the renewal have a enrollment and reporting requirement that will be subject to here. In the prioritization of how that is approached, I'm interested, you don't have to answer that today, but as this gets closer, I'm interested in how you implement both enrollment and prioritization of work subject. You know, there's a great universe of land use out there. There's some that I think don't need a waiver at all because they have no discharge. And then there's some that, like proximity to water, by riparian, by land use, or by practice, that have then are subject to that. And I think I could, the enrollment process, I think we, just knowing enrollment, kind of how that could go out there, that in and of itself is a very big step.
Sure. And, you know, we've already begun some work on this and thinking about it, and also, you know, some analytical work. The approach that we're thinking of basically amounts to a risk-based approach, where we're trying to identify the areas that present the greatest risk to water quality, and what we're settling in on is, you know, those riparian areas where management activities that could affect water quality are in close proximity to the stream courses, and we've done a bit of work to identify, you know, what that subset of properties are, and I think that would be the way that we would like to move forward in terms of our prioritization and focus. But you know what you're talking about really speaks to the graphic that David has prepared, and so that whole topic I think is really what we're wanting to address with the discussion about that graphic. Well, I mean, I'm just saying we're going to be talking about that. So.
Yeah, understood. And here's the thing, too, in the interest of time, we have a post-session requirement today that's rather large, so I don't want to cut you gentlemen short. Neither do I want to limit public comment here. But I'll leave it to your discussion. You can have me stand it out, and I see this as a roadmap. So at your discretion, then bring the charts up and discuss them.
Just to make one comment building on this discussion about enrollment and reporting, it is a big deal, first of all, and we believe that there needs to be consistency, frankly, between the SCOT, the way that we, our requirements with respect to enrollment and reporting between the SCOT and the Shasta. They need to be compatible. In other words, in the current waivers, the expectations are that there is enrollment and reporting in the Shasta, and there's less so or non-existent in the SCOT, and that needs to change, frankly. There needs to be more consistent across watersheds. And that that we as staff, as we're developing these revised waivers, we need to be very clear and clarify what our expectations are with respect to enrollment. And that's, we're thinking along this kind of risk-based approach that Brian just talked about, as well as expectations regarding reporting. But then the key next part is our expectations about the consequences for non-enrollment and non-reporting, that we need to be clear as a regulatory agency to communicate to folks, well, what happens if you don't enroll or you don't do the actions that we expect? And so one of our jobs is to be clearer from a progressive enforcement standpoint, frankly, about what do we intend to do for non-enrollers.
And I think we're in agreement on that. And this graphic is intended to try to capture just the things that you were saying. And I'll just walk through this, if I may. This is a conceptual permitting framework that incorporates the concept of risk as a way to prioritize our efforts. So on the left hand side, I've got an arrow there that says increasing risk to water quality, running from the bottom where there are activities with no discharge, and that, as you mentioned, Mr. Noren, that would be compliant with the prohibition. I mean, if you're not discharging, you're compliant with the prohibition, so that's where that fits in. And then a large area in here that would be addressed by a conditional waiver, and then the provision for a waste discharge requirement permitting mechanism for particularly high-risk dischargers. So focusing on the conditional waiver, the idea here is that even within the waiver that we would have gradations, if you will, of those that are covered by the waiver. At the bottom, there we conceptually are thinking that there would be activities that have de minimis discharges associated with them that would actually, this would be even below the waiver bottom line. So we have two categories there: one, activities with no discharge, and those activities with de minimis discharges. Neither of those would be part of the program. There would be no enrollment required. Within the waiver, what we've been thinking about is a concept where there are some parties covered by the waiver who would have an enrollment requirement, and then other parties who would not. That we could write the waiver in a way that provides them coverage but doesn't require them to enroll. And even refining that a little bit more, that we could change the enrollment requirements, the enrollment conditions, as a function of time. And that would reflect our capacity in some way. We would look at the highest risk dischargers, set enrollment conditions that would reflect what we can accomplish over the term of the waiver, and work on that, and then come back after 5 years, see how we're doing, and then have the possibility of modifying those enrollment requirements to include others in the program that we hadn't picked up on the first time around. So the enrollment conditions would change over time, and would reflect our capacity to address. I've got some fee information there. We don't anticipate that would apply to the Scott and the Shasta, so this is a general graphic. We do anticipate that concept will apply to the ag discharge program that we're developing region-wide. So I won't spend any time on the fees, but except to say that in the typically enrollment in the region-wide program is likely going to trigger a fee of some kind. That's right. It's a state board. It's a condition of the state board fee structure. That's right.
I think that's very good.
Thank you. We anticipate a workshop in August, and then to bring a waiver for your consideration in October.
Chuck Sancho, Cutton resident, Eureka. I didn't come here to talk on the Scott and Shasta River, but you touched on a couple items that I think are worth mentioning. Having dealt with the rural landowner issues for 50-plus years, you know, there's some things I think you might be interested in hearing, and they're worth repeating. You've probably heard me say them before. I kind of wrote it down so I could be short. In the real world that I live with, the rural landowners, proving your innocence is getting tough. It's getting costly, and the regulatory hammer's getting a little heavy. So that's just a thought. You've heard me say that before. Just keep that in mind. And it's especially bothersome when there isn't detrimental impacts happening. I mean, you folks got to spend money and time chasing these things. We got to spend money and time telling you we're innocent. This is all kind of a waste of time when it's not detrimental. So keep that word in mind. It's very important that you deal with detrimental issues. You can have all the plans you want, but the cumulative impact is forcing a lot of people into what I call business decisions. They financially can't do certain things, so they let the land go, they move out, or whatever. I mean, just keep that one in mind. I've had my best results, or I think the best results, when I've had the strictest regulators make sense. I don't argue with them. They don't argue with me. We work it out in the field, and we get it done. So that's something else to kind of keep in mind. I think you folks have a heavy responsibility when to use the regulatory hammer and when not. So that's your field people. I think you need, I was at a media group last night at Access Humboldt, and they were having trouble with money and people and following up on hard news and verifying things. And I think you are faced with the same thing. You got money and people, you got to allocate them to the right place. So one of the things they were missing, I think, was the field expertise. You need, having dealt with water quality since the inception, you've heard me say this before too, you need more field expertise involved in your decisions. That's all I could say. And I guess I'll leave you with that. It's just getting tough out there for rural landowners to do everything everybody's telling them to do. And it's not just you folks. It's all over the place. So you touched on working with the landowners and Scott and Shasta, and that's good. But you got to kind of get out in the real world and see some of the things I guess I'm talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Mr. Danny Meyer.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Myers. I'm representing the Redwood chapter of the Sierra Club. The gentleman before me said we should look at specific events. Felice Pace reported several violations over the last period since your last meeting that were, I thought, quite significant. I didn't see that there was a response to those. They seemed like they would be a teaching opportunity in this process. In other words, there was an issue raised about you need to define what the conduct should be for more precisely for these waivers. I would just like to know whether there's been a response to those events. So there were cattle, I guess, that were fenced into areas that involved them being in coho breeding areas and substantial reduction of riparian vegetation in those complaints. I was not here for the entire process, so I might have missed something in the beginning. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't recall precisely which were the complaints that Felice Pace made at the last board meeting. We do have a complaint tracking system, and so all of those complaints went into the tracking system. And I believe for the ones that were at the last board meeting, staff has gone out and has been talking to the landowners. We have also made some shifts in our staffing so that we have increased priority to follow up on enforcement issues and complaints within particularly Scott and Shasta. So that added resource will help move some of the complaints with some of the landowners forward. We also have had some good success from some of the complaints, and some of the landowners have or are proceeding to fence and do various activities. So it's a mix. We've gotten some compliance, some non-compliance that needs to be followed up on, but it's a mix. But be assured that those are all being tracked and followed up on.
Thank you. I'm Marilyn Seward, and I'm the chairman of the executive board of the Scott River Watershed Council, and I'm also the treasurer of the Scott River Water Trust. So it's been kind of heavy what's here, and I wanted, my husband always said, people, not programs. And so I wanted to just acquaint you with some of the things that are people-oriented. I wanted you to know that the ground, the well monitoring program for the last 2 years in Scott Valley has been funded by a private donor to the extent of $12,000. And so that's been handled. That's pretty good, I think. I wanted you to know that the Scott River, the Siskiyou RCD, is struggling because of the demise of the ITP program. And because there has been a great difficulty in getting permits from some of the agencies to do simple work, the grant money is available, and permits have been over a year in coming, so employees haven't been able to be paid or work hasn't been able to be done. Watershed Council at our meeting this week agreed to increase the cooperation level with the QVIR, which is the Quartz Valley Indian Reservation. There's new management out there, and we are enjoying a really great level of cooperation. They're suggesting they can get the money if we can help do the work. So it's a wonderful step, and we're encouraged about that. My coordinator, Daniel Yokel, and I talked also. We have been frustrated about the difficulty of getting before your board a complete list of the good things that are happening. And so we personally feel, and I don't know that I'm speaking for the Watershed Council here, but we personally feel that a reporting contingent in the new waiver is good, that it will force us to report what's being done. So those are just some things. And I want to say that I've appreciated working with Brian over in the Valley and with Andrew Baker over in Scott Valley, or Shasta Valley also. Thank you very much.
Okay, and with that, I expect we will have, as discussed, we will have updates in the near future with workshops. The Shasta would go first in June, followed by the Scott that follows it soon thereafter. Any comments back from staff at the end of this? Anything you've heard that you want to address?
I don't really have a whole lot of comment to add, and I know we're short on time. I also have the next item, so I'm coming up here for that. But I did want to say that there has been significant progress in getting one of the enforcement cases that are complaints that Mr. Pace has brought up to our attention a number of times. The complaint was cows in the creek, and that landowner is now fencing off the creek and is also working with the RCD on repairing planting. And so we're making progress. I also wanted to say that I'll be up there towards the end of this month with Stormer Filer Enforcement Unit, and we're going to be paying more visits to landowners. So that's all happening and moving forward.
Session and come back somewhere around 1 o'clock. We will take then at 1 o'clock, we will take on
talk to the F River TMDL. But I might be corrected here.
Let's even get the water quality objective done, and we'll cut short the confusion of the discussion.
Now, do water quality now.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, let me suggest something. There's a suggestion to take on the water quality. We have Holly Lomborg to do a water quality objective amendment for us, which I believe is, I assume it was, I was told, about a 30-minute duration. Before we do so, let's do this. Then what we will do is we'll take a break till 11:30 and come back, start at 11:30, and take that on before a break at lunch then in closed session. I'm sorry, Brian.
We still need an action on the renewal, the short-term renewal of the Scott conditional waiver. So I'm wondering when we will have that heard.